Shares. Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that has the first current account surplus in 44 years. Well, not us so much, but the government and the country, and we're taking credit, basically. I'm Scott Phillips, and with me, as always, is my co-conspirator, co-current account surplus deliverer, Anirban Mahanty. G'day, Doc. How are you?
G'day, Captain. I don't have a surplus in mind. I would like to have a surplus.
I would current account, national current account surplus, the first time in 44 years.
Can you divide that by the 25 million people and then just get some checks?
No. We've got a big show planned, mate. We've got a few things to cover off. We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the trade war slash talk slash something, whatever's going on between Presidents Trump and Xi, but not for long. Just going to check in because the markets are loving what's just happened. We're going to talk about a new competitor for Afterpay. We're going to talk about, speaking of first profit in years, or first current account surplus in years, Meijer, the beleaguered department store. I think it's officially beleaguered. I think that's what we call it. Has finally turned a profit, maybe for the last time, or maybe there's more to come. And a whole lot more. Let's get into it.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate, let's start off with the big macro, and there's not much bigger or more macro than good old Donnie and President Xi sitting in a room, virtual room, across maybe a Zoom call or a Skype call or something. I wonder what they use.
They might use some secretive stuff.
Well, maybe. That's pretty cool. I like the idea. Maybe the red telephone thing I always like the idea of.
Big with the big dials.
Yeah, exactly. It's got to be big dials. It's got to be handset.
The hotline. It's called the hotline.
Exactly. Mate, so the US market was up. So this is, we're recording this Friday morning, as we tend to do. The market was up strongly overnight. It was up more the night before. And it all seems like it's because, well, crisis over. Trade talks are back on. Everything's okay again. Isn't it?
Well, you know, it looks like this is the movie I've seen playing before. Seems like there is a crisis, then there are trade talks.
Oh, and
then there's a crisis, then there's a trade talk. So right now, it seems like there's going to be some talks in October. So the market is going to be happy maybe until October. And then at October, when the talks may fail, market might be unhappy.
This has got more sequels than Rocky. This is Rocky 8 or something.
This is like a television show that's, you know, rocking on with its, like, you know, the season 2, season 3, season 4. Nobody wants to watch season 5, but it's still giving you season 5.
I have memories of Happy Days and the whole jumping the shark idea that at some point the trade talks get to the point of farce if they're not already. Okay, so that's all true, except the market is not taking it as lightly as we are. Shares are up. I mean, again, only small percentages, but overall decent amount of money. Up 2.5% over 2 days. Someone thinks this is good news.
Well, you know, here's the thing, right? So let's say the tariffs have gone into effect, right, on a bunch of things, at least in the States. So if the tariffs have gone up, gone 15%.
The Trump tax, I like to call it.
Okay, I'll just call them tariffs for what they are. I'll let you do the politicking. You know, I don't do politics, right? I'm a very neutral person.
I know.
I have lots of opinions, but that's different. So let's say,
man,
you
hear him off air. Man.
Yeah, like 15%. 15% extra, things are costing. But at the same time, you've got, the Chinese currency weakening. So, you know, it's like, is it really 15%? It's no longer 15%, right? Because the currency has weakened. So maybe it's like only like 5%. I don't know, right? So there's all these little dynamics. And then, you know, goods being moved around because you can move things around. So nobody really, I mean, sometimes I think the reaction to the downside is an overreaction at the same time as, you know, like nothing really has happened. People are saying that they're going to be talking in the future and in anticipation of this talk in the future, which could get canceled anytime between now and the future, the stocks have gone up. So, yeah, it's a little bit of like a seesaw. I think that's the best way to put this is there's just more volatility. And maybe this is more like normal volatility because we've had a period of time where volatility has just not existed. So, you know, we should just get used to the fact that this markets are supposed to be volatile, because if they are not volatile, everybody would be in the market and then we would not get the market returns.
And speaking of President Trump, apparently the cyclone's going to hit Alabama, I heard yesterday.
That has got nothing to do with tariffs.
Someone with a map?
I have no idea.
That was pretty funny. If you haven't seen it, Google President Trump Alabama cyclone. It's pretty funny. All right, shall we move on?
Can I use Bing for search?
You can't use Bing for search. Bing, seriously. Yes, I know he's a character from Friends, isn't he?
Oh, no. It's a beautiful search engine from Microsoft.
Dear, dear. Stand by.
Get more Motley Fool money advice at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, mate. We're going to leave Bing there. Well, let's bring this back home. This is a pretty... So, look, you know, if you're a slightly economic wonk, and I might possibly fit that bill, the first current account surplus in 44 years is pretty bloody impressive. Not much. Only happens once every 44 years, right? I think Halley's Comet about 87 years. Our economic boom has lasted for about 28 years. But 44 years since the last time Australia had a current account surplus. Now, basically, and there's lots of maths behind this, but effectively, we exported more than we imported. That gives us a current account surplus. Largely, don't, if you're a super economic wonk, don't spam me with stuff, because I know it's not exactly the definition, but it's close enough for our purposes. We're a trading nation. It is the first time in a very, very long time, almost half a century, that we've delivered a current account surplus. Now, there's a couple of things here. I'll get your thoughts in a minute, but I just wanted to highlight two things. The first is that, yes, and we'll talk about GDP numbers in a sec. The GDP numbers are a bit soft, and the current account surplus contributed about 0.5% to growth, which is about a third of the growth that we delivered. So that's a pretty good result. The other thing is that this is exactly what a floating currency is supposed to do, right? I saw someone on Twitter say, yeah, it wasn't Twitter. It was actually one of our blokes on Skype, actually. He said, yeah, but if you exclude the currency movements, then it was less than that GDP number this is. It's like, yeah, that's kind of the point, right? Currencies are supposed to float. And get out of KG if he's listening. Currencies are supposed to float. That's kind of the point. So when people talk about the currency being lower, and there's some sort of, you know, national kind of, I don't know, I'm trying to avoid any vulgar comparisons here, but it's some sort of measuring contest, right? When you think, well, the dollar's high, therefore it's good, and dollar's low, therefore that's bad, and higher is better and bigger is better, so therefore if the dollar's lower, then somehow that's some sort of national tragedy. It's kind of what's supposed to happen when the economy is weaker than the rest of the world, when you know, our exporters need a little bit of extra help and the dollar's lower. That's exactly what's supposed to happen. So I kind of figure, yes, would the GDP have been worse if you know, the currency didn't float? Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of why it floats. That's almost the point in itself. So good current account numbers. I don't think it'll be sustained at that level. A record number, by the way, which you would expect, because in 44 years, the inflation's gone up a little bit. So you'd expect that to be a record. Whether it continues is probably an open question, but this is exactly an example of why, kind of crappy if you're going to America anytime soon, you're not going to be getting much for your Australian dollar. But if you're an exporter, if you're sending wheat or oil or iron ore or manufactured goods or wool or anything else around the world, a lower currency helps our economy in a period of weakness.
Cool. Yeah. I mean, that's all correct.
Don't say but.
But I have a but actually to this. I actually don't care at all about that surplus.
Boo.
And the reason I don't care, I'll give you an example. Okay, I'll make up an example on the spot, which is always dangerous.
All right.
Okay. So let's say I'm I have the Scott Phillips Shoe Company.
Don't be some snazzy shoes, just
okay,
quietly.
Okay, the Scott Phillips Shoe Company is registered in Barrow or Mittagong or, you know, wherever, or Wagga Wagga,
yes.
Is the headquarters.
Yes.
And you have this brilliant design and this beautiful design. It's very Australian.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody in the world wants it, right?
Yes.
Including
as well, I should.
Including Australians. But we don't make it here. We make it in Vietnam.
Yep.
Right. And let's say we make all the stuff that, you know, we create the IP for all the stuff, but
yes,
it's actually made elsewhere. So mm-hmm. we import that stuff.
So you're saying the best thing I bring to it is my fashion sense.
Well, but you know, but you import it, but
right, right.
So you as a company still own all the profits for that, right?
Yes.
This doesn't show up
yes.
in the current account surplus,
correct,
does it? Right. So, I mean, you know, this is a little bit of a, so I think the current account surplus is a good measure, and it's a good measure for a country like ours, which sends a lot of raw goods.
Correct.
Raw material for other people to produce stuff out of it, which could be construction or, you know, making cars or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an indication of that. But, you know, that's why I just don't, you know, it's a good thing, but, you know, it doesn't, you know, current account deficit doesn't necessarily mean it's bad either, right? It just depends, I think.
I think that's true. I just wanted to, I guess, make the point that overall a floating currency does what it's supposed to do. And so to some degree, I want people not to be too freaked out or worried about the fact the dollar falls, because again, fall sounds bad, rise sounds good. it's supposed to move to offset economic weakness locally. That's exactly what I agree with currencies that. Do.
I agree with the currency part completely. I mean, the currency should move based on, you know, so in fact, a lower currency impact implies that our economy is actually not that strong.
Right. Relative to the rest of the
relative
world.
Relative exactly. worse. And therefore, it's making our exports, which in this case happens to be iron ore or coal and mm-hmm. whatever else, and mm-hmm. it's making it competitive, which is exactly how it should work. And that part I totally agree with. We agree on stuff today.
We'll edit that out later. Okay. No one wants to hear that.
Okay.
Let's move on.
Motley Fool Money. For more, go to fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, we've talked about Afterpay quite a lot in this podcast, and it's because it is, well, frankly, as a stock, it's probably almost the hottest stock in the land. There might be one or two more, but not many. A spectacular rise. A huge number of customers, a huge number of merchants. At last count, 5.2 million customers. That probably makes it the biggest kind of retail exposed business outside the credit card companies and the banks in the country. 35,000 merchants here and around the world. And so it's no surprise that there is a truckload of competitors turning up to take its place. We know ZipPay's been around for a while. We've heard of Splitit. That's kind of, doesn't quite hit the big time, but it's around. Bumble is a new one that was announced by the Flexi Group mob, the people behind Certegy EasyPay, the best brand in the world, so no one ever. And now, good old Jerry Harvey, at Hardly Normal, has done a deal with Latitude, which it's one of those, you know, not many people would know Latitude. It is the biggest non-bank lender in the country, which I got to say, I was surprised to read. I try and keep my attention on these sorts of things. It's a private company, so that's part of the reason we haven't heard about it. But most people, if you ask them to name a number of lenders, most people wouldn't even mention Latitude, let alone it be the largest non-bank lender in the country. But it's those two are teaming up. Latitude and Harvey Norman to offer a thing called Latitude Pay. So guess what that is? Yep, no surprise. It's buy now, pay later. Things are getting a bit interesting in this space, mate. Now, we've talked a little bit in the past about Afterpay, a little bit in the past about the kind of economic impact of these services that let us kind of push payments into the never-never. Just your thoughts on another buy now, pay later competitor, what's happening in the space. I should say, too, one of the big things that Latitude is making a very, very big song and dance about is they are saying, hey, we are voluntarily going to be subjected to the national credit code, whereas the likes of Afterpay and Zip choose not to be and are not required to be because of the fact they are not charging interest. So there's some sort of regulatory arbitrage potential there. Your thoughts on Latitude and where the space is right now?
Cool. Good question. So, okay. Let me give you a stat first. So,
we like numbers. Numbers are good.
Afterpay is adding about 12,000 people, customers, per day.
That's phenomenal. 12,000.
Right. So that kind...
Do we know the breakdown geographically, just out of interest?
Oh, well, like, I mean, you know what? They had in 15 weeks, one of the fastest, you know what, 200,000 people or something like that in the UK. That was their fastest adoption.
That's amazing.
So one of the things that's happening with Afterpay is, which I think is interesting, is the brand basically developed its strategy in Australia. Right. And then they've expanded to New Zealand.
Right.
Then they went to the US. And then for the US, they launched with, you know, things like, you know, Urban Outfitters, like big brands and big retail partners, and they rolled it out there.
I'm gonna sell my shoes there at Urban Outfitters.
The company headquartered in Wagga Wagga, it can sell it at Urban Outfitters.
And they can pay with Afterpay, which is everyone's a winner. Afterpay.
Right. So everybody is a winner. So all the money comes to Australia then.
Yep.
Right. Now when they went to the UK, seeing the success that these guys have had, Urban Outfitters have had in the US, they have, you know, people are volunteering and putting their hands up and saying, okay, we are really happy to be the launch partners for you. Seeing the retailers are basically helping attract clients or customers for Afterpay.
And so that was the great Afterpay success story. So way back, I remember when it was first launched. I'm an idiot because I didn't buy the shares or even recommend them. But I remember them talking about the fact it was something like they were growing the basket size number of customers in retailers, in the trial retailers they had, by some stupid number, it was 40% or something dumb. Like it was, and not I'm not saying dumb as in they're lying. This is legitimately great, right? So this was why they were accepted so quickly. They were able to show really, really clearly to every retailer they went to, if you offer Afterpay, this is the impact we are having in other retail partners. That's no retailer's going to sneeze at that, right? They all want a piece of that pie.
Yeah.
And then you multiply that by the next 35,000 merchants, as I said.
Yeah.
No surprise they're getting people to take it up in different countries.
So I think, you know, what you know, they've got a well-oiled engine and they've demonstrated success. And, you know, this is one of those things where the success sort of breeds more success, right?
Yeah.
And the point, the reason I brought up Urban Outfitters as an example is that this is an international brand, right? So an international brand which finds success, say, locally, would be happy to actually carry the Afterpay success to other markets, right? So going, you know, it's a great strategy. Start in Australia, small market, demonstrate it. Go to US, the largest brand market in the world. Mm-hmm. Most of those brands are available internationally. So if you're successful there, you can carry your success to other markets.
Now, it almost gives you that leapfrog effect, right? Because you're saying, well, if I can get the global guys to like it, they'll roll it out for me almost.
For me, exactly. So this is brilliant strategy. And it took me a while to actually sort of figure the strategy out. But, you know, this is brilliant strategy. Now, if you add that kind of customers every day and people see that you're being successful, well, you know, success brings a competition, which is exactly what is happening.
Right.
Now, it is, I think there's the... So I don't think this is a winners take all type of market, and it doesn't even have to be. It's a huge market, right? And there are different types of, you know, payment modules, right? People, you know, who use, so Afterpay, for example, 85% of their people are paying back via debit card, not credit card. So this is not the credit card market.
Yep.
This is the debit card market.
Right.
So this is another way for those people to pay. Other people can participate. Now, of course, the other people have to find a launch partners. Like, for example, Latitude has found, like, you know, Harvey Norman.
Right.
But it's a different market because they're, you know, Harvey Norman and Latitude, they're basically participating in this bigger packet, bigger payments. Now, Afterpay is doing something like this called a variable upfront pay. That's, you know, so basically instead of doing four equal payments, what Afterpay is saying that you can choose to pay more upfront, that's your variable pay, and then you make three equal installments, and that allows you to, you know, buy, say, tickets, and, you know, so they have a partnership, for example, Jetstar. So it allows you to get into this travel sector where the payment, you know, where you're no longer buying $100 jeans or a $200 shoe, right? So in fact, Afterpay is inching into these other markets, which people like, you know, Latitude, for example, Latitude finances for, like, and if you want to buy a phone, Latitude finances, like, you want to buy a sofa. So I think there's some intersection here, maybe some not, you know, there's some overlap, but not that much of an overlap. Does it worry me? Not really. I mean, the fact that these guys have gone ahead and established a beachhead in many of these, with many of these brands, it is really hard for the other guys to catch up. But they can be, you know, in this different niche sectors, they could be successful. I mean, in a way, Latitude is basically playing in exactly the same. Latitude has been for years financing, Harvey Norman furniture, right? So, I mean, this is just another way of saying, well, I'll continue doing that, but I'll also give this other model that people want, right?
Yep.
So it's incrementally maybe better for Latitude and Harvey Norman.
Net-net? Not worried about Afterpay, maybe something with Latitude. I can't imagine.
You know, I'll tell you, I'm worried about Afterpay from one point of view, right? Mm-hmm. And maybe I'm less worried now. What I'm worried about is in this part of the economic cycle, where, you know, there's not been a recession for like 29 years. This is like a huge record. You know, it'll be great that there's never a recession, but... maybe there isn't another one for like many, many years, but who knows, right? I mean, the thing is that recessions are a reality. They do happen, right? Mm-hmm. The fact that it hasn't happened for a long time is an issue. And therefore, it is during these cycles of downturns is when we would know whether or not their systems of checks and balances actually work or not. The good news is that they have diversified before a recession happens, and they've gone to other markets.
Assuming there's a global recession, of course.
Yes. Again, we don't know. So yeah, if there's a global recession, that's one thing. If there's a local recession, that's another thing.
Yep.
If there are recessions in a large market that they participate in, then that's another thing. Like, there could be a recession in the US and no recession here, for example, right? How does that affect? We don't know, and that's the risk that we are taking, because they're basically taking the credit risk, right? And
that's what worries me. So I on that credit, we won't spend too much more time on this, but if you think about a credit card company that charges me $400 a year for the card itself, and then charges me 20% if I'm overdue on anything, versus a buy now pay later provider who takes all the same credit risk in theory, shorter periods of time, smaller amounts, so take all that for as read. But they are charging a much, much lower margin on the money, At some level, yes, the banks are making a squillion bucks on credit cards, and that's a horribly uncompetitive space. And we'll talk about that, funnily enough, in a Money Hacks edition coming up, so stay tuned for that one. But at some level, it just strikes me that if you can provide the same service for literally a fifth of the margin, effectively, a fifth of the price, if you think about it that way. It does make me worry that maybe some of these companies are going to be more exposed. Otherwise, the credit card companies could, in a competitive market, have already pushed rates down to this. Even the not-for-profit, you know, the credit unions and the member-owned banks are still charging 12% on credit cards. It's a very, very big drop to 3 or 4% that Afterpay, now they're getting paid by the retailers, that's different. But to some degree, they're still taking a decent amount of credit risk with it's not a bad balance sheet, but it's not as strong a balance sheet as maybe some of the other financial institutions around.
Yeah, so my quick comment to that would be that, yes, there's a risk, right? But I think the bigger risk is not with Afterpay. The bigger risk is the people that are coming in now, Latitudes and the Certigies and the Bumbles, who are basically taking a product that would have allowed them to get a 20% interest when people fail to pay on time and now have moved it to a Afterpay model. So they're the ones, I think, who are, you know, I think in great danger of actually folding and getting into real trouble when, you know, well, the times are bad, right? I mean, when the times are bad and you want to buy your jeans, you're probably going to buy your jeans. But when your times are bad, you might actually default on your sofa. And Harvey Norman is not going to come and take that sofa away from, or Latitude is not going to come. Harvey Norman has got the money. So now Harvey Norman doesn't have the problem. Latitude is probably not going to come to your home and take that sofa away because, you know, they're going to get nothing for it.
Right.
So I think the problem is for these bigger payment packets and things like that. So I think, net net, it's Afterpay is targeting this environment where it's looking at millennial people, it's looking at people who are actually paying by debit cards. You know, so it's the intersection is actually relatively small. So I actually I'm more fearful about the bigger packet ones, the ones who are actually offering more credit, and therefore taking more risk across a smaller set of customers.
That's a good point. Last question, quick answer. If you fast forward X number of years to this market becomes mature, how many meaningfully sized buy now, pay later providers are there going to be? You've already mentioned, so one I didn't mention was Comsec has made an investment. Is it Klarna? I think the Swedish mob. Mm-hmm. They're apparently going to launch that here, I heard, during the week. Mm. That's yet another buy now. I think it's six I can count to already. I'm betting that won't be the last one. In 5 years' time, how many of these are there?
Well, like, I mean, I would say maybe 3, 4, 5. Like, I mean, you know, I think the market could be very similar to how the credit card market has evolved, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, you know, or the credit payment gateway markets, right? So, I mean, there's American Express, there's, you know, Visa, there's MasterCard, and then there are, you know, these other ones like Diners, and the much smaller ones, more exclusive, more... So maybe 5, 6 will be my guess at the max, but it's probably going to be like, you know, a couple leaders is right now. There is nobody really that's challenging Afterpay in a meaningful way.
Mate, I lied. I have one more question for you. It just occurred to me then.
This looks like I'm giving an interview here.
Sorry, mate.
At least maybe I should get a raise if I answer them correctly.
I promise you I'll pay you double the podcast rate.
That's like almost zero.
Correct. Exactly zero. In fact, I'll triple it. There you go. Mate, so one last question. What I like about, what I think is interesting about Bumble, now Bumble is being offered by Flex Group, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. It's actually promising to do it without involving the retailer at all. And so the interesting thing about Bumble in my mind is if it's successful, it requires an app on my phone, but the retailer doesn't necessarily have to accept or otherwise take that particular payment method. Bumble manages the payment through the MasterCard network. So at some point, I do wonder if you have a thought as to, after I may have christened this market, how much risk is there in, at the moment it's like the retailer offers it so I can use it, which is great, same with Zip. At some point though, if this all becomes appified effectively directly and you can choose whichever app you want to use to pay your bill, rather than relying on the retail's own infrastructure or deals, does that undercut Afterpay or does it have enough brand recognition and place in the market or is it simply just a better model? How do you think about the rise of the kind of, it's effectively, I mean, Bumble's effectively a credit card by another name, right? But to the extent that Afterpay was effectively debit card by another name over, yes, a couple of extra payment periods, the likes of Bumble could well disrupt Afterpay's own category only a couple of short years after it was launched.
So that's potential. So I don't know exactly how. So how is Bumble making the money is the question, right? How's
credit card interchange fees?
Okay, so credit card. So like, you know, there's a higher chance that Bumble will be killed by somebody like Apple Pay. Right. So somebody like Apple Pay will probably destroy and, you know, and trample.
So Bumble gives you the chance to do the multiple payments, right? Bumble's combining the credit card infrastructure with a pay later solution in a way that no one else is yet. I'm not saying it's going to be successful, by the way. I have no idea. But it just strikes me that if you can take buy now, pay later and appify it, that potentially undercuts the retail point of sale methodology, which Zip and Afterpay are using.
Yeah, so the two things, right? So one is, as I said, most of the people who are using Afterpay are not credit card holders. Sure. They do not hold credit cards, so they're not using credit cards. So that's a different market, number one. Number two is that I think whatever Bumble is doing is likely that if Bumble can do it, somebody like, you know, Google Pay and Apple Pay can do it. And therefore, I think Bumble's strategy is, I think, at a much higher risk than anything else, right? Because, I mean, you know, if I have, if that is successful, there's nothing that stops Apple from doing exactly the same thing with the Apple Card. And
I don't necessarily mean Bumble being successful per se. I'm more at the impact on Afterpay itself.
Yeah, so,
if that becomes appified rather than retail-led.
Yeah, so I think there is an appify chances there. But I think, again, that has a direct impact on banks and credit cards. And, you know, there's an opportunity here for banks to offer a different form of product.
Right.
And I would say it's going to be tech-led, right? Exactly what Apple is doing with Goldman Sachs in the U.S. Like, you know, it's a different type of credit card with points and, you know, no fees and no late fees or whatever it is. Like, you know, no interest fees or whatever. I don't know exactly what it is, but no late fees. But there is interest fees if you, of course, I think miss payments. You know, instant rewards offered as cash. So I think there is a chance that tech players will disrupt the credit card side of the market, right? So these guys not going for now, of course, there's going to be intersection where, as I said, you know, they're trying to go for this variable payment, which is the credit card side. So yeah, so there's going to be competition, but it seems to me, at least right now, their bigger risk is an economic risk than competitive risk.
Okay.
In my mind, economic risk, a recession, a global recession, aren't even now an Australian recession, I think is, you know, it could actually be the problem, right? So, I think that, you know, they're executing very well. They've got a really, you know, class team now. So I think it's good. And people just need to realize that it's, you know, it's risky for those reasons. That's my take, at least.
Topic for another day, mate. But there's a lot of cheap money sloshing around the market. I mean, some of these things are made available because there's a whole lot of cheap cash going around. I do wonder whether a Latitude Pay, a Bumble or whatever would get off the ground 3 years ago, or maybe in 3 years' time when money's a little bit tighter and there's not as much just super low interest cash being sloshed around the VC market in particular.
That is so true. I mean, the market basically, well, there's cheap, you know, the money is cheap and is becoming cheaper, right? Everybody's expecting more rate cuts, you know, and that's not just here. It's like, you know, I've heard comments like, you know, negative rates are coming. So
let's see.
Value stocks.
Market. Stock market.
Index.
Share market.
This is Motley Fool Money. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, speaking of negative rates, let's talk about negative sales. Poor old Myer. Yet again, negative same-store sales of 1.3%. That is that they made $100 worth of sales last year. This year, $98.70 worth of sales. You can't run a business that way. Except that, for the first time in a very long time, I think 9 years, Myer actually delivered a profit. Feels like more than 9 years, I've got to say. But this, square that circle for me, mate. You've got a business that can't seem to grow, yet goes from loss to profit. What sort of alchemy magic is being weaved by the Myer board?
It's got to be some accounting magic. I haven't looked into this. Because this sounds, you know, like Myer is a big box format, right? Yep. So it's got big fixed costs. So I don't know how you can actually go from loss to profit. I have a guess. I'll take a guess. Maybe they've sold some buildings or sold something and they've booked an accounting profit for selling that stuff, which is basically then showing up in the statutory books without looking at the books. That's my best guess.
Yeah, a couple things going on there. I don't know about that necessarily. A couple things I have done is they've closed some stores and they've closed some loss-making stores. So if you can cut off the gangrenous limb, to use a little bit grotesque metaphor, you can all of a sudden become healthier by comparison. So if you can close a loss-making store, then guess what? You lose less money with the rest of the network. That can help. They've also renegotiated some supply chain stuff, some supplier costs, that kind of thing. So this is a little bit of an engineered result. I love, by the way, companies who can do that. They do a good job of managing costs. That's super important. But really important to remember that you can't cut your way to greatness, that someone wise once said. I can't remember who it was, but I've used it ever since. At some point, the kind of year-on-year savings you make from that stuff go away. And you've got to still try and find a way to get more people to come into your shop and spend more money while they're there. And if you can't do that, it's a very, very tough business to be in. I think that remains the risk for Myer. On the flip side, so earnings season was funny, mate. We kind of talked about this during earnings season. Retail was a really interesting mixed bag. The department stores, Myer and DJs, really struggle at a sales level and certainly for DJs at a profit level. Excuse me. Myer, Target, Kmart, Target, Big W struggled in the discount department store space, similar story. And yet we did see some success. Harvey Norman, Jerry Harvey, his usual rambunctious self, was very positive and hanging some stuff on his competitors. JB Hi-Fi did well. Super Retail did well. Kathmandu also did well. There was a decent number of kind of success stories in retail and some businesses that got hurt. And I don't want to do a too simplistic a story here, but it seems like online retail might have been a meaningful differentiator between these businesses. DJs and Maya still can't quite get online to work as well as they want to. The likes of JB, even Harvey Norman, belatedly and surprisingly for me, Super Retail similarly, these guys have done a really, really great job of turning their business into quasi-online models, at least for that part of their business. And that, to some degree, seems to have been, if not their saving grace, certainly a big contributor to what was, frankly, a very good result. I mean, some of these companies did, you know, had a very good result. Now, the market wasn't expecting much, so you know that helps. But these were, you know, in tough economic times. We've talked about retail sales being soft. We've alluded to the fact that GDP growth was the lowest in, 10 years. These retail numbers, on some cases, pretty good. In other cases, pretty diabolical.
Yeah, like I think you know, there's good retailers, right? I mean, JB has isn't JB? I thought it's one of the highest shorted stocks on the ASX or something like that. Like, I mean, you know, if you're a good executor, you continue executing. But I think here's the problem with anybody making a negative bet. As long as they can hang on to their negative bet, there is going to be a time when they're going to fail, because and that's like any good thing stumbles occasionally, right? And
when you say fail, you mean more that stumble rather than fail?
Yeah, I don't mean like a fail as a business at all. Like, I mean, JB is phenomenal as an executor. But you know, like, these businesses have just high fixed costs, right? And you make a profit on the delta over that. So there's going to be a time when you make a smaller delta, right? And it's not that it is, it can just happen. So I think the big box ones are kind of struggling, is my opinion. Like, things like the Myers, that's just too big, right? So there's huge upfront rent costs involved. Too many items in the stock. You have huge inventory. So I think that hurts. And, that's why things like, Toys R Us and stuff have closed. But the smaller ones, they're doing well. And, I mean, people need stuff, right? Mm-hmm. People, JB's, at least in the one JB Hi-Fi that I crossed by, it's like always teeming with people. I just don't understand what people are buying.
It's fascinating, right?
It's fascinating. Full of people. So
this was a $20 stock, by the way, at the beginning of this year, now a $33 stock, a gain of more than 50% in a traditional retailer, in theory, was going to get destroyed by Amazon and Kogan and a recession and everything else. As you say, I think that's right. What is the lesson here? Is it to always buy quality? Is it to back the ones that have got momentum and growth? Is it to, how do you, if you can, how do you explain the JB success? Even the last 9 months, what was the market so badly wrong about? What lessons are there for long-term investors in this, if any?
So I don't know. Like, this is a hard one because, personally, I just look at retail and I think it's just too hard and I just don't buy.
Right.
It's too hard. It's, limited runway for growth. It's like, it's a really value-picking area, right? So if you thought value, there was value, and and if you have the tenacity to hold through, like, some ups and downs, then there is an opportunity to buy these things at value and then, sell when they become overvalued.
Right. Okay.
You need to have a good understanding of, the low and the high end. I'm not suggesting trading, but really it goes from being pessimistically priced to very optimistically priced, and then it basically cycles around that.
You don't have to be a trader to do that, right? That is some pretty stock standard value-ish type investing where you're just simply saying, look, at this price it's too hard to ignore.
Yeah.
And at that price it's too hard to ignore selling it, because if I'm being offered a stupid price to buy and then a stupid price to sell in a different way.
Yeah, absolutely.
You're kind of mad not to do it.
Yeah.
Because there's no unlimited growth story here. A big software company with a world of opportunity can grow for decades. So can a retailer, but only at very, very small rates, because at some point JB Hi-Fi would be bigger than the Australian economy. And so at some point there was a price where if the market says, hey, I'm going to give you 20 times earnings for a huge, unrepeatable level of profit, well, you're kind of mad not to take it.
Exactly. So I think maybe that's the right strategy with many of these things. And I would still not short it because, again, that's just too much risk, too much timing risk involved, and again, your limited upside and things like that. So I mean, again, there's good retailers and bad retailers, and online doesn't kill everything. And you have to remember the retail as definition is like everybody is basically operating on small margins, even the online guys, right? They're all operating on small margins.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, I had some thoughts, man. I'm more a retail investor than you are, which isn't hard because you don't invest in retail at all, so it doesn't take much. I think the story here is I think the businesses that are that have the right economic model are the ones that are going to be successful. And I think, you know, DJs and Myer were, I've said this before, were the shopping centres of the 1950s, 60s and 70s. Mm. You know, Westfield didn't exist meaningfully until about 1980. I mean, there's some around, all that kind of stuff, right? But for the longest time, if you went into, and this was a suburban experience, you went into the city, and whichever city you're in around Australia or town, and you went to the shop that had everything. And DJs and Myer were the shop, and even the discount department stores to the same degree. You get toys and clothes and gardening stuff and car stuff. And, you know, these were the one-stop shops. You went to the shop, the Myer of the DJ, you had lunch there. You did your full shopping. You bought your shoes and your pants and everything else at the one shop. And then the shopping centre arrived in a really, really big way. And now you can go across the hallway, across the aisleway, and you can go from a specialty shoes retailer to a specialty clothes retailer to a specialty car retailer. We've talked about a few of them already. Mm. That change, when all of a sudden you couldn't just be the only place people went, now you've got to think, well, why would you go to a Myer or a DJ's? Why would you go to a Big W or a Target? You can get it online. You can get it in a different shop. At some level, there's just not the same customer demand. And I think one thing is important, by the way, is to remember as a consumer not to project your own shopping preferences. Mm. If I did, I would never have bought a whole lot of retail shares that, frankly, I never would shop at because I know other people do, and that's the important part. If you see relevant companies are doing a really good job of being relevant, as you said, mate, one of those kind of Peter Lynch, who's a famed US fund manager, one of his tests was literally you walk past the shop, and you, as you said, the JB Hi-Fi near you, chockers. Well, that's a pretty good place to start. Say, hey, they're doing something right. Even if it doesn't instinctively appeal to you, even if you would never walk into a JB Hi-Fi, I'm not saying you would or not, by the way, but if you didn't, you can still look at a whole lot of people and they go, wow, they've got something going on there. I wonder what it is. And I think while you can remain that relevant, while you can actually provide a shopping experience in a holistic sense that is better than jumping online or better than going somewhere else, that's a pretty good sense that you're going to be at least an interesting stock candidate. Not always. And you have to be very careful because, that said, they can turn on a dime. DJs was once a wonderful business. Now it's not so much. That can happen, right? And we need to be aware and aware of those changes. But in the meantime, if you can keep a relevant, I've said lots of times, if you can sell more products to more people over time, that's a pretty good recipe for growth. And generally speaking, depending on price, a pretty good recipe for investment success.
Real money advice from real people. Not just a couple of dicks with a Porsche. Get more at fool.com.au/MMM.
Mate, I'm going to get on my high horse.
Do it.
I've had enough.
Do it.
I'm mad as hell. I'm opening the window. I'm not going to take it anymore. Mate, seriously, I saw during the week a tweet from someone who claims to know, and I can't verify this, so I will leave it in the allegedly camp. It's reported that Westpac is suggesting or potentially proposing, a 35-year mortgage. That's right. We're not in enough debt yet. We're not borrowing enough money yet. We're not paying interest for long enough yet. Westpac want us to pay more by giving us an extra 5 years to pay off the loan. Not out of the goodness of their heart, but because they get to make some extra money in the process. This is quite literally one of the worst financial ideas, not easy to say, of the last 12 months at least. Now, this is a year we've had Royal Commissions and more buy now, pay laters you can poke a stick at. There are more ways for us to gamble and lose money. And yet, somehow cloaked in the special clothes of financial decency is the idea of a 35-year mortgage. Now, let's sit down and have a think about this for a second. A 35-year mortgage, yes, guess what? You pay slightly lower monthly repayments. Is that great? No, because any money you don't pay now, guess what? Sits in that account and compounds. Mm-hmm. If you're not paying an extra couple hundred bucks a month today, that couple hundred bucks you're not paying today is worth a couple of $1,000 by the time you finally get around to paying it in 2043, right? This is the big problem with longer mortgages. They feel good because they pay less per month. You got to pay more in interest. Now, some people have said to me, no, it's okay. Yeah, you pay a little more interest, but at least people can afford houses because the repayments are lower, right? So I can now afford to buy that house because I'm now paying a couple hundred bucks less a month. Luckily, that's inside my budget, which would be wonderful, Doc. Except what happens, mate, when everyone gets more time to pay?
They pay more interest.
They pay more interest. And they all decide, you know what? If I can pay a little bit less per month, well, I can afford to borrow a bit more, can't I? So for the repayments, are going to charge me $2,000 a month in repayments. Now it's $1,800. Brilliant. Except Mr. Bank Manager, friendly old bank manager, says, you know what, Scott? You can still borrow enough to pay off $2,000 a month. That means your borrowing capacity goes up by 10%. guess what? You can now pay $600,000 for that house instead of $550,000. How good's that? And when we all have more borrowing capacity, mate, the prices go up, which is wonderful if you own a house. I own a house. I'm happy with that. For those poor bastards who are trying to borrow money, guess what? We all get locked into 35-year loans. Now, some people have said to me, this is the last one. Some people have said to me, you know what? That's fine, but people won't do that. I say to them, remember when we were kids, when I was a kid, maybe not you, Doc, the 25-year mortgage was the standard. That was the most the banks would lend you. Then guess what? It went to 30 years. And we're all still paying as much of our income now as we were then, which means we all borrowed more and pushed house prices up. Is that really not going to happen this time? As John Elliott would say, pigs patoot, it is going to go up. If there are 35-year mortgages, house prices will go up. We'll be in more consumer debt. We will spend less in the physical economy. How good is that as a recipe for economic success? Ba-bow, it's not. Absolute disgrace. A 35-year mortgage, I don't blame Westpac for throwing up the flagpole. That's their job. They're a bank. They're entitled to make some interest. It is time for the regulator and the politicians to say, guys, enough. 35-year mortgages, huge thumbs down for me. Absolute debacle. Should not be allowed to happen. Yes, the market gets to do what the market gets to do. More debt, more interest, more repayments is terrible for the Australian economy. We're already in tough economic times.
Do you feel good?
I feel so much better.
Awesome.
Thanks, mate.
Motley Fool Money. Financial advice for real people, not trust fund hippies. Sign up for the newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM.
All right, now I'm refreshed, mate. I'm ready for it. We're going to dip into the Fool mailbag as we do every week. We got a really kind of cool question a couple of weeks ago. We're catching up a little bit. So please do send us your questions, comments, and feedback. We will give you the details of that a little bit later, but get the old pen ready, the iPhone, the mental kind of notepad. The first one came from Nick Berger on Twitter. Now, he basically retweeted a tweet from another bloke and said, hey, Scott, what do you reckon? And I'm not going to answer. I'm going to make you answer it, Doc, because that's what I do. This was just a really interesting kind of take on some economics of a particular business. And it's a US business, so we won't dwell a lot on that particular business in itself. But interesting idea of kind of the way some companies make money. The tweet said this: Starbucks has $1.2 billion in total unredeemed value on Starbucks cards, which is like a 0% loan from customers. So in America, you can buy, you put credit in your Starbucks card now, use it over the next 12 months or 2 years or 5 years. They've got the money now. I don't get the coffee for a couple of months or a couple of years. They get that money to use on their own behalf until I finally redeem it for my coffee. That in total is $1.2 billion, which effectively its customers have advanced Starbucks at 0% interest. Gets better, mate. It also recognized $145 million, or 12% of that, as what they call card breakages, i.e. the value customers aren't expected to redeem. So not only are we giving them $1.2 billion globally to use just for free, effectively 12% of that will never, ever, ever be used because we dropped, lost, broke, rolled over, threw away our cards. Is it, I wouldn't say this is a rort necessarily, but it's not a bad way to make money, right? If I could kind of loan out my future earnings, knowing that I could borrow it for free and that I would actually end up getting 12% more than I think I'm going to get, that's kind of like a negative 12% interest rate they're paying for the privilege of doing business. And Nick says, Scott, is this worth a deep dive on this week's show? And I don't know about deep dive. I think we're going to talk about it though, because I don't know about a rort, but it's about as close as it gets, right? If I knew I could do that, I'd be doing it every day of the week.
So I love this question. And I am actually a Starbucks shareholder. So I love this.
Oh, you so I've been I'm happy to say I don't have a Starbucks card, mate. You'd be happy to know.
I've been a shareholder for over like, you know, 6-7 years now. this is an example of a great brand leveraging its great position
to screw its customers.
To make customers happy by letting them put money so that they can have coffee in the future. I mean, this is what happens when you have, like, basically any awesome brand is able to do these things, right? I mean, you know, people load up iTunes, right? And Apple never discloses how much I think they have on iTunes, but I'm guessing it's a few billion. So, you know, I think, yeah, this is an example of, again, great brand power. It's free cash, basically. I mean, on the balance sheet, it'll sit as a liability, right? So, I mean, from a technicality point of view, it's a liability.
It's a pretty bloody good liability to have, isn't it?
Yeah, like, but you know, great brands have an ability to attract money. Not so good brands don't have the ability to attract money.
The other thing too is this $1.2 billion is not buying $1.2 billion worth of coffee. Like the profit margin of coffee are probably still 70%. So effectively they're getting $1.2 billion up front, something that's going to cost them, what, $300 or $400 million to fulfill.
Yeah.
So they're already making money. They're already making profit on the purchase anyway, and they're getting that all up in front. Man.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, the company like Starbucks probably takes all that cash and puts it in like, you know, U.S. Treasury. So they're actually not making any money on that cash, really. Like, oh, man, I mean, how much are the U.S. Treasury going to pay them? It's probably going to pay them like 1%, right?
Except for the breakage money, right? They're never going to have to redeem.
The breakage money, I get. But the breakage money, you know, like I think that will disappear over time because, you know, I believe most of the cards now so have transitioned to electronic, right?
That's
so people are using everything on the phones now. So this is probably from historic
cards.
So
you lose your phone. Right, exactly. Yeah.
So even if you lose your phone, you have not lost your account, right? Mm. I mean, you know, if you get another phone, it basically... So I think that 12%, I think that goes.
I have to ask, mate. Last question.
Unless it's people dying and stuff, I don't know what happens then.
It's a bit macabre, dude. Let's not go there. It's Friday morning. Come on. It's almost the weekend. It's a blue, sunny... It's a beautiful day in Sydney.
But, you know, people do die.
Can we be happy?
Well, you know, if people did not die and companies like, you know, the funeral home companies, they would not be happy.
I look forward to Starbucks funding people's funerals with their Starbucks card balances. Mate, one last question. Who the hell preloads credit on Starbucks card when there's tap and go? Like, I get it in a non-credit card world. If you don't have $5 in your wallet, I've got my phone always on me. I've got my wallet always on me. I've got a million ways to tap and pay. Who is mad enough to go and say, you know, I'm going to put $100 on my Starbucks card rather than tap the credit card or the debit card on the way through?
So this is the illusion of discounting, right? So, you know, you buy a Starbucks card somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
That says if you buy like $100 of Starbucks credit, I'm going to give you 10% discount.
Oh, okay. Right? So that's why people are doing it.
Well, like, you know, like I buy iTunes cards when they're on 15%. Yeah. It's, you know, like, I mean, if I think about the time value of money and things like that, then maybe I shouldn't. But, you know, when I see that 15% discount, mm-hmm. my mind goes, oh, 15% less. I'm going to get it now.
The sirens are calling you on the rocks.
The sirens are, you know, so I load up on the card because, hey, it can pay for my Apple Music and everything else that I'm going to buy in the future. But you know, I'll have a few $100 sitting on the iTunes card, you know, and on the iTunes account, right? And it's pretty normal.
I can save you a fortune, mate. Stop using iTunes.
Captain, I use good quality things. You know, did I say I have Starbucks high quality brands?
Oh, right? Let's not get into Starbucks high quality.
It's a high quality brand.
With poor quality coffee, arguably.
That doesn't matter. As long as it makes money, it's high quality.
Motley Fool Money.
Mate, we got a question from George K on Twitter. He says, he's addressed it to me, but I'll assume it's for both of us. Hi, mate. Love the podcast with yourself and Doc. How good's that?
That's awesome.
Is it your brother George or my brother George?
Not my brother.
Must be my brother. I don't have a brother George. Maybe it's not you and with a fake account.
I don't have fake accounts. I have hardly one account that I can manage.
He says, I'm a bit confused on how CGT, capital gains tax, is calculated on a portfolio where one regularly contributes into an ETF, say $1,000 a month, and then needs to sell the entire portfolio in one hit. Good question, George. One of those, we don't do a lot of kind of this technical kind of tax stuff or investing stuff, but a really good question from George, a really good, concise, succinct question,
mm-hmm.
which we'll try and answer relatively concisely and succinctly. Mate, George contributes regularly to an ETF. He wants to sell it all, or he may have to sell it on one hit. How the hell does CGT or capital gains tax work?
Well, I would think that CGT, again, this is not a tax advice. Mm-hmm. I talk to your accountant. Not use my advice to do your taxes because if it's wrong,
if you do,
I am not
sue
responsible.
Him and not me. That's right.
No, if you need money, you just sue Captain. he lives in Metagong, you know, in the nice, beautiful rural area. And he's got a dog.
Man, I need the petrol money. Come on.
Okay. So if technically your brokerage should have account of when a transaction was made.
Mm-hmm.
Based on when a transaction was made, that date basically qualifies as your buy date.
Yes.
So if you have bought 10 units or 10 shares of an ETF today, that particular shares need to be held for more than a year or 1 year or more mm-hmm. to qualify for the capital gains tax benefit, right? So you'd basically look at every unit or installment of purchase and mm-hmm. you basically decide on that. So if you've got some that you've held for more than a year and some that you didn't, you pay more on the one that you didn't hold and you pay less on the one that you did hold.
Yep. Yeah. So George, basically if you'd bought, say, over 5 years, let's say yearly over 5 years to make it simple. You bought the first lot at $1, the second lot at $2, second lot at $3. Let's assume the share price was nice and linear. The last lot at $5 on the way through and $4 in the middle. Effectively, as you sold each for, say, $5, your capital gains tax liability is calculated on each individual parcel. Now, if you're doing it monthly, that effectively, in accountant speak, in tax speak, is a separate parcel with each different transaction. And each transaction has its own cost base, to use the accounting term, and its own sell price. And the difference between those two is simply your profit on the trade. It's a little bit complicated if you have to get all that paperwork. And as we would always say, please keep your paperwork up to date, because you don't want to get yourself in trouble if you have to somehow work out what your tax liability is. But effectively, your liability is calculated at each of those purchases. So you bought some at 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5. You bought some at 5. Obviously, some have a larger liability than others, and they are all individually calculated, as Doc says. And as we would always say, if you want to, well, you don't necessarily, I wouldn't necessarily keep them just over here just for the sake of tax, because you might lose money in the meantime. But if you're going to sell, just be mindful of what you bought when, as Doc says, so your tax is calculated appropriately. Decent answer?
Mm-hmm.
We got a question from Travis, mate. Now, to be fair, I didn't want to read this question.
I love this question.
Travis,
it's a great question.
Travis, have a good hard look at yourself, mate. You've got massive, massive issues. Travis says, hey, Scott, love the show. Thank goodness an earbud is back. I don't even...
Travis, mate, you just said the right thing.
I don't even know what to do with that, mate.
Yeah, it's great.
Travis, you need help, dude. Come on. Be reasonable. I have feelings, Travis. I'm a human being. I'm a person. I feel pain. I don't know why you want to be like that.
He said, love the show.
Yeah, but I think you... No, you won't. Travis has a question over three near identical ETFs. With three ETFs all tracking the top 200 companies on the ASX, why are their share prices different? Aren't they tracking the same thing? With the ASX being the recent, so one particular one, the A200, being the recent darling due to its low fees, its share price is now $111 compared to IOZ at $27. Why would I buy A200? So these are three different products, all tracking the same index, all with different unit prices. They call them unit prices on the share prices, same thing. Travis's question is a really good one, mate. So if three products are all tracking the same index, how can their share prices be different?
But the simple answer is it depends on the number of units that have been created, right? So if you have more units, the share price per unit share price goes down. If there are mm-hmm. less units, the per unit share price goes up. The other factors could be, so effectively, they all will track in terms of percentage returns their benchmark, or they should closely track their benchmark if they're good indices. And the other thing is that, you know, the tracking error will depend on, again, how they implement the tracking, right? So is it, you know, uh-huh. are they doing a quarterly balance or, you know, are they doing daily balance or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever mm-hmm. they're doing, whatever is the process. So that's going to decide some of the tracking error. And then they should be doing quarterly balance if they're doing ASX 200, right? Because that's in the S&P ASX 200, which basically does a quarterly rebalance. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, they shouldn't. And the other thing that will matter is the fees, right? If the fees are different, then that will contribute to the tracking error.
Right.
I shouldn't call it a tracking error, really, the difference between the benchmark. The performance of the things. Those are the things. So, yeah, there's no such thing as, you know, lower, you know, again, I'll just use this to reiterate one point. Lower share price doesn't, for, you know, just the low value of the share price means nothing. The high value mm-hmm. of the share price means that there are stocks mm-hmm. which are, Berkshire Hathaway is like, you know, several thousand dollars, mm-hmm. Not several thousand, several hundreds of thousand dollars for the mm-hmm. share.
$306,000 at last count.
Yeah, but I mean, it doesn't matter. Like, I mean, of course, you have to buy one, therefore, you know, it costs you a lot more money. But for all intents and purposes, all that you really care for any investment is mm-hmm. the percentage increase.
Right.
So, and the dollar you've invested. So you mm-hmm. invest a certain dollar amount, you want to know how much the dollar amount and the percentage basis goes up or down.
So Travis, let me add some color to that. If you've got two companies, both worth $1 million at market cap, so the whole business worth $1 million, one of the companies has 10 shares, they're worth $100,000 each. One company has 1 million shares, they're worth $1 each. Which company is cheaper? The answer is they're exactly the same value. They're both worth $1 million. They're just slicing up the pie in a different size slices. And to Doc's point, that's what he means by the number of units on issue. In some cases, they're simply just a different calculation of the same base. Now, if there's one at $27 and one at $111, just to choose those two numbers you gave us, if the index goes up 10% next year, you can be reasonably assured the $111 one is worth $122, give or take, and the $27 one goes up to $29.70, which is 10% on both. So it's the gain you're going to make will be the same proportionally, as Doc says, with the exception of fees. And kind of going back to that, we would always say at The Motley Fool, I think I'm fair right by saying, incorporating everyone's view on this, you should always go with the lowest fee solution. As long as the provider is a decent, reputable provider and they're doing the right thing, low fees always beat higher fees almost exclusively. We particularly like Vanguard because they're not for profit, so they're going to more likely to have lower fees over time. But in any case, lower fees are almost always the best one. So if you're saying which one to choose, again, all else being equal, and we haven't looked at these in detail, but all else being equal, if they're all run by reputable providers, go with the one with the lowest fees.
I'll just quickly add that, you know, low fees, as long as you're looking at the same index. So, like, you know, it's the same index.
Totally. Yeah. It needs to be the same product.
Same product. Yep. If you're replicating an S&P 200, S&P ASX 200, then, you know, they should be following the thing.
If you choose between an ASX 200 and a NASDAQ, for example, then fees are less important directly.
Yeah.
It's more about the product you choose. The right product first that has the greatest after-fee expected return or the best diversification benefit, whatever else you're doing. But yeah, I should have said that.
And there are hundreds of ETFs these days, which are, because they have active strategy ETFs as well, right? Which are doing like all bunch of different things. Well, I don't hate all of them, but, you know, like, it's good to know that, you know, that there was something that looks like ASX 200, but it's not really ASX 200.
I think that almost made sense.
Yeah, I think so.
Jai, we've got a question from you, but we're going to hold that to next week, and I'm going to try my best, Doc. Last time I did this and gave a teaser about a question, I forgot to do it the week after. So, Jai, hold me to this. Jai wants to know about infrastructure investments and tech stocks and remuneration. He says, my second question might be more up Doc's alley. Again,
is
Jai.
Is it my remuneration he's talking about?
Jai, if you want to keep asking questions of Doc, you are not going to have your question answered on this podcast. I am the star of this bloody show, and the quicker you find out, so you realize that, the better for
us. Talking about my remuneration going up. I like this.
No, he's talking about tech stock remuneration, dude.
Darn.
Although I'm not entirely sure you're not on the payroll at Apple based on your kind of regular pronouncements of joy and light from the company. Are you sure you're not getting remunerated by Apple for your positive comments? Is there any cash for comment going on here?
Not yet. I just own some shares.
He says.
Yeah, but and I probably buy more. I buy a lot more of Apple stuff than the dividends I get. Let me put it this way.
Mate, you make it back in proselytizing and evangelizing. Don't worry about that. You are well and truly worth more than your spending. Mate, on that something note, horrible note, great note, funny note, I'm not sure. Depressing note.
It's an awesome note. Let's just say this. Awesome. The podcast is awesome. People love it.
If you want to get in contact with us, speaking of which, you can email us info@fool.com.au or hit us up on Twitter, much more fun, @TheMotleyFoolAU, or I'm @TMFScottP, and Doc is @AnirbanMahanti. Hit us up on Twitter, leave us a comment, leave us a question, give us some feedback, be kind. And remember, as always, we don't care if you're positive about the podcast or not. We don't care at all whether you say nice things about me in particular. But if you don't, good luck getting your question answered on the podcast. That's probably enough.
That is.
We done?
Yeah.
That wraps us up. But before we go, don't forget you can and should subscribe to the Triple M Motley Fool Money podcast through iTunes or your favorite Android podcast app. And if you like what we're doing, please give us a big rating on iTunes or that Android app. Leave us a review. Leave us a comment. Share it with your friends. Help them get a little dose of foolishness too. And you can get some of that straight to your inbox by going to fool.com.au/MMM.
Triple M.
That's it for this week's Motley Fool Money. Stay tuned later in the week for our special Money Hacks edition. We'll be back next week with a regular podcast and another dose of foolish insight. Fool on.
Fool on.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/MMM. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.